You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, April 21st, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Paolo Gerbado, sociologist and author of The Great Recoil, Politics After Populism and the Pandemic. Meanwhile, the Russian military has conducted an intercontinental, always have a hard time saying that, ballistic missile test with the potential to carry a nuclear warhead, an attempt to show strength as its brutal war in Ukraine rages on. However, in good news, after the new CDC guidance indicated so, the Biden administration is appealing the Trump-appointed judge's ruling that overturned the mask mandate on planes, trains, and other transportation. Happy to see that. A memo that was leaked to the press says Bernie Sanders has not ruled out a 2024 presidential run if Biden does not run for a second term. Intrigue. And new reporting sheds light on how Republicans reacted in the immediate aftermath of January 6th. McConnell reportedly wanted Trump impeached, and Kevin McCarthy planned on telling Trump to resign. But after a few days, some temperature checking of the base happened.
So Kevin's a wimp. He could never have done that in his wildest dreams.
Little Kevin.
So are you stuttering, Kev?
Israel's attack on Gaza continues. For a second night, Israel warplanes bombed the Gaza Strip, the most intense string of violence that we've seen since last year's 11-day assault on occupied Palestine. They also conducted a brutal crackdown of the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan, once again. And lastly, thousands have fled Arizona and other parts of the Southwest as wildfires rage. The fire swelled to nearly 20,000 acres yesterday. The springtime wildfires in this area will only increase in size, length, and intensity as climate change continues to dry the area. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. A reminder, because I've been seeing some chatter about if I've fully taken over the show and where Sam is. If you just tune in, on random days, you might not know. Last week, Sam had COVID. This week, he's recovering, but had a pre-planned vacation. So we will have Sam back next week, God willing.
The triumphant return on Monday, yep.
Yeah. Some notes on that, making sure everybody understands. Sam will be back. It's not a permanent takeover by myself. But if you want to see us in person, please go and get those final tickets for the big live in Boston at the Wilbur Theater on May 15th. There are not many left. Check them out, folks. The big live, as we've been calling it. But first I want to highlight this story because we had a viewer write in about this, a listener of the program, IM'd us about this story of Melissa Lucio. So I'd heard about this in passing, but didn't fully know the details of it and wanted to make sure that the audience was aware of it. People are pleading for Texas to stay the execution of a woman named Melissa Lucio, who says she was wrongfully convicted of killing her toddler, Mariah, in 2007. And it appears, based on the reporting, that it's quite clear that she did not mean to do this. The Innocence Project is working on her behalf, and you'll see when you hear the evidence. And not that she didn't just not mean to do it. The evidence seems to be growing. She had nothing to do with the death of this toddler. I'm going to read from a Guardian piece. On the evening of the 15th of February 2007, a team of five police officers in Cameron County, Texas, began an interrogation of a Mexican-American mother whom they suspected of having murdered her two-year-old child. Melissa Lucio was in a vulnerable condition. She was pregnant with twins and in the grip of shock and grief. Just 2 hours earlier, her youngest child, Mariah, had been pronounced dead, having fallen unconscious. The officers did not let the suspect's vulnerabilities get in the way of the inquisition. Over almost 6 hours, stretching late into the night, they applied to Lucio the notorious Reed technique, a controversial interrogation method that has led to numerous wrongful convictions in the U.S. As trained to do under the system, the officers put their faces within inches of Lucio's, screaming at her that she had to know what happened to her child. They had lots of evidence. She was to blame for the death, they said, forcing her to view photographs of the girl's lifeless body. Then, as the Reed method dictates, they abruptly switched tone. They gently reassured her that she could, quote, put this to rest if she would only confess to having caused the toddler's death. Lucio insisted over 100 times that night that she was innocent. But after more than 5 hours of aggressive maximization and minimization, as the technique is known, she reached a breakpoint. She began to repeat the phrases that the investigators had effectively coached her to say. I don't know what you want me to say, she told them. I'm responsible for it. I guess I did it. That coerced confession was the core evidence presented at Lucio's subsequent trial. It was critical to the jury's guilty verdict and to the death sentence that followed. Abolish the death penalty in general, because there are a lot of cases like this, by the way.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, the death penalty question is one of, I think that's it's a purity test of your basic seriousness. If you believe in the death penalty, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt that you haven't thought of it deeply. If you have thought about it deeply and come to that conclusion, I'm going to take you for a political enemy. But this is, it's bad in a generic sense when you don't have this sort of law enforcement abuse of like a coerced confession like that, but knowing that we do have these sorts of abuses, like it's
indefensible.
Unbelievable that
yeah.
we would allow like these sorts of agents to take people's lives.
Even in, say you were able to guarantee that everyone who got the death penalty was guilty of their crime, it's a wrong position. It's impossible to guarantee it. In fact, we know that there's a very significant likelihood that the person being put to death is innocent. And it seems like in this case, the Guardian continues, a mounting body of evidence, which much of it never heard at trial, some of it actively suppressed by prosecutors, points to a very different conclusion. Mariah was not beaten to death by her mother. She died of internal injuries from an accidental fall. And now Republicans are calling for a stay on her execution, too, in the state of Texas. This is such an egregious case that it's not just the Innocence Project. It's not just leftists or Democrats. Her execution is set to happen on Wednesday. So time is of the essence here. Hundreds of religious bodies, along with women's and domestic violence advocacy groups, have joined celebrities such as Kim Kardashian to plead with the Republican Governor Greg Abbott and the state's Board of Pardons to intervene. Lastly, just another piece of evidence. As Lucio was being interrogated by Cameron County detectives in a separate room in the police station, some of her other children were also being questioned. They told investigators that their mother had never been abusive or violent in any way. The children also said that 2 days before Mariah died, they had seen their siblings accidentally fall down a steep flight of stairs on the outside of the house they were renting. Lucio, who was busy getting the children ready for school, found the girl at the bottom of the stairs crying. So that's what they believe the injuries were attributed to. And you can read more of this Guardian piece to show how the medical examiner presented false testimony that was taken seriously at the trial. One of the Texas Rangers also testimony that was false, etc. So, especially to Matt's point, you're unserious if you have thought anything about politics and still support the death penalty, because one, it's a position that cannot be defended by morality or by the outcomes and the incentives that it's supposed to create. It's really just brute vengeance at its core and brutality, but also it is relies on a complete lack of knowledge or ignorance about police work, and the incentives that police officers have to rush to conclusions about cases, regardless of the humanity of the person that they're locking up and potentially sentencing to death. And the prosecutor pursued that in this case. So, yeah,
and that technique, the Reed technique, what you mentioned, like, it's just disgusting that you deploy that on a grieving mother, as opposed to how many rape kits are unprocessed at that police department?
Right.
Probably tons and tons. Like, you want to go protect people, go protect people.
But before we get too depressed by that story, I just wanted to highlight it because next Wednesday, as I mentioned, is the deadline for this execution to be stayed. We'll have a little bit of fun before we are joined by Paolo Gerbado. Donald Trump sat down with Piers Morgan, a very unlikely journalist to be pressing Trump on this. But, I mean, he's after the January 6th insurrection attempt, Piers Morgan was open about saying this is insane, ridiculous. He's a right winger, but he's a little bit more steeped in reality than, say, Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So he was able to get this interview with Trump, and he tried to pin him down on the question of whether or not the election was rigged, stolen, et cetera, or not, which is completely manufactured by Trump in order to preserve his own ego, but has been eaten up by his followers. Here's the trailer for that interview. It is arguably the sweatiest Trump has ever looked. It seems to have been edited together by Michael Bay with a lot of smash cuts and dramatic music. And apparently, Trump walked out of this, this interview. Let's take a look.
Okay, Piers, I'm ready.
A former president in denial.
I'll be completely straight to your face.
I think I'm a very honest man. Much more honest than you, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
It was a free and fair election. You lost.
Only a fool would think.
You think I'm a fool?
I do now, yeah.
Excuse me. Okay, with respect,
the legislature
is the hard evidence.
Excuse me.
The most explosive interview of the year.
I don't think you're real.
This I really is just, I'm not like,
very dishonest. Let's finish up the interview.
Morgan versus Trump.
Turn the camera off.
Very dishonest.
Turn the camera. Very dishonest. I'm excited for that.
I think you're fake. I just like the idea that Trump is finally going to be pressed by a journalist about the big lie. And, you know, I don't trust that it's Piers Morgan doing it because I think he's personally objectionable and I don't trust his sort of reporting. But that said, it looks like it did enough to piss Trump off there.
Yeah, but the point is right. Like,
what's the evidence? I got the evidence right here. We're going to deploy it at Trump's desk 2024.org.
Excuse me. And the interview now. I'm pretty pumped about that. It's the perfect way to get like a guy like Trump to agree. You know, you have to get him to agree to the interview first. Piers Morgan is perhaps the only non-One America News Network, Newsmax, or Fox host. The only person maybe outside of those three networks that can get Trump to, or some, you know, random evangelical station that he'll call into while taking a dump. But I mean, regardless,
as far as journalists that will ask him about that.
Yeah. That's the best we're going to get. Yeah. And, probably the only journalist that he's spoken to in recent times that hasn't ate up his BS election fraud stuff. So look, he walked into the bear trap and we're all going to have some fun with that, I think.
I wonder if this is part of the, DeSantis formation. If this is trying to like sink our boy Donnie and put the establishment DeSantis in there. I'm curious how this is going to play out.
Yeah, maybe, you know, we'll finally see that spray tan melt off his face in the middle of the interview.
Ooh, if he lost to DeSantis in a primary, that'd be very bad.
I can't see it still. I can't see it.
Neither can I. That's why I'd be so insane.
Yeah.
He might have to, like, I don't know, disappear forever.
Commit some cuckoo or whatever. It's the end.
The honorable thing.
I hand it off to you. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. But first, 420 was yesterday, but the sale for Sunset Lake, C to the B to the D. Oh, hell yeah. It's still ongoing. 40% off smokables like hemp flower pre-rolls and Keef, and 30% off everything else. There is no promo code needed. Products are already discounted on the website. I mentioned earlier in this story about Melissa Lucio, the Innocence Project, working on her behalf. This is a great organization that does wonderful work like this. And Sunset Lake and Majority Report are teaming up to turn everyone's favorite stoner holiday into a fundraising opportunity for the Innocence Project. They're working to undo the damage of the war on drugs. Here's how it works. Visit sunsetlakecbd.com. Starting Wednesday, April 13th, Sunset Lake CBD will be offering 40% off smokables like hemp flower, pre-rolls, and keef, and every other product will be 30% off. I use the tincture every night, pretty much. I mentioned that, but I want to start using the keef and the smalls a little bit more, too. So that will be up next, and maybe I will be using this discount. Sunset Lake will donate 4.20% of sales to the Innocence Project, a nonprofit organization that works to free the innocent, prevent wrongful convictions, and create fair, compassionate, and equitable systems of justice for everyone. Sunset Lake is a majority employee-owned business that donated more than $26,000 last year to anti-drug war organizations, animal shelters, union strike funds, nature conservation, food shelves, and refugee resettlement organizations. They walk the walk, ladies and gentlemen. Sunset Lake is a company that has ethical business practices, and we're proud to partner with them. Again, visit sunsetlakecbd.com to take advantage of these discounts and help Majority Report raise money for a great organization. The sale ends April 24th, right before midnight. Don't miss it. You don't want to miss out on the sale, folks. And it's great, a great product. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will be joined by Paolo Gerbato, sociologist and author of The Great Recoil, Politics After Populism and the Pandemic. We are back, and we now are joined by Paolo Gerbato, sociologist and author of The Great Recoil, Politics After Populism and the Pandemic. Paolo, thank you so much for being here today.
Hi, Emma.
So, The Great Recoil, let's just start with that phrase. What does that mean?
It means that many things that we took for granted over the last decades should not be taken for granted anymore. We got used to things happening that were unthinkable, right? The pandemic, the war in Ukraine, now the ever more present effects of climate change. And all of these unexpected things are the recoil of the failure of globalization. The way in which globalization has opened new risks and dangers that the market cannot solve and that the only the state, only state interventionism can address.
So your position is that the pandemic laid bare the stakes of continuing down the path of neoliberalism, of globalization. But who did the pandemic lay down the stakes for? I mean, you saw Biden sort of adopt some of this rhetoric, right? We're not going to cut the social safety net to a degree. We're going to attempt to add to it, but Build Back Better failed, right? So it seems like there's an understanding among the regular population that this economic system of globalization and neoliberalism is failing. But the ruling elites are still behind the eight ball a little bit. They're behind the ball.
It is a global trend, right? I mean, in China, they are talking about a dual circulation system. They don't want to be the factory of the world anymore. They want to concentrate more on domestic production, on more high-end goods, high-tech goods, technology, even AI. They want security in energy and food while engaging still with a global market. There are some countries that are rethinking their relationship with globalization, realize that they want to protect parts of their economy. Part of this is also seem to be the spirit of Bidenomics initially. In a sense, like created a more protective sector for the national economy, in a way, increasing standards for workers after years and years of race to the bottom. But we also saw that there are very big opponents to this strategy, Because there are interests that don't want this to happen. I mean, Kyrsten Sinema, Joe Manchin, right, in Congress. And trust me, there's Kyrsten Sinemas and Joe Manchins all over the world, in Italy, in Britain, in many other countries that are very fiercely resisting this change because many people have something to lose from this.
So basically, they are the firewall against capital, or for on behalf of capital, and there are people around the globe that represent that in the same way. Eventually, hopefully, the hope is, I guess, and I found, you know, your thesis to be a bit more hopeful than some of the others that I've seen, is that that kind of politics can eventually be cracked because a new consensus is being reached.
Yes, I mean, my optimism is limited, I have to admit, but it has to do with the fact that some of the most short-sighted dogmas of free market economics and the so-called free market society are being abandoned. They are actually being abandoned also by sections of capital itself because they are untenable, right? I mean, it is now evident that you cannot count anymore on a stable global market and whatever, locate your production anywhere in the world as if there are no risks of geopolitical instability around, for example, right? But this doesn't mean that we are being delivered from neoliberalism and somehow automatically led to something nice, to whatever, social democracy, let alone socialism or whatever, eco-socialism. Rather, my thesis is that we are moving to a different battlefield that is different from the battlefield we were used to over the last 40 years, where both the center-left and the center-right, to a great extent, had to accept that what was at stake was what kind of management we should develop for the market economy, how we should manage the market. There were more compassionate ways and more cruel ways of managing the market, but there was an acceptance that that was what pop politics revolved around. Now, instead, the key political question has changed. It has to do with what mission the post-pandemic state or the post-global state should have. And there are very different narratives coming from the right and from the left, which have to do with different politics of protection, with different ideas of what state should protect.
So I wanted to get into that, right? How the right presents protection of, you know, certain cultures, and the left is about protecting institutions of social safety net, adding to them to an extent, but also protecting the environment, for example. Can you build on that, the dichotomy and the different presentations of protection from the right and the left?
I found writing this book, protection, as a very revealing concept, because I discovered that it was something very profoundly rooted in political philosophy, like in the Western political philosophy from Plato onwards. Many of the classic authors that people are supposed to read in college, right, or in high school, actually always insisted that politics fundamentally has to do with protection. Because protection is the minimum condition for society to continue. Like, if you don't protect society vis-a-vis many dangers, natural or otherwise, society will simply disappear. Yet, this idea of politics as protection, in a way, disappeared during the neoliberal era, because it was felt to be too oriented to the collective, too paternalistic, whatever, authoritarian.
Keynesian. Yeah.
Exactly, Keynesian. But now you instead clearly have a situation where fragility, vulnerability, exposure to risks is a major issue on the agenda. But for the right, the risks are mainly migrants that indigenous workers they consider want to be protected against, and property. I mean, property that wants to be protected against redistributive demands, people asking, you know, tax the rich, redistribute money, and so on and so forth. For the left, instead, it has to do with realizing that unless we protect the human habitat, it's not anymore the habitat of polar bears. It is our own habitat. Like, our society is going to see a deterioration of living conditions. And that also we not need to reclaim security as social security. Right, which was a key slogan of the Labour in the UK, like of the New Deal, Social Democrats in Sweden and other countries. The Swedish Social Democrats had this beautiful phrase, secure people there. Only if you provide people with security, with some stability, people can thrive and can develop all their skills and all their ambitions.
So this is in a sense, a reclamation of big government, or you know, you describe it as neo-statism. What do you mean by that?
I mean, what I mean by that is a very broad and still rather amorphous consensus that is taking shape, and which has to do with this simple affirmation of we need more state intervention, which inverts the worldview of neoliberalism, which both in its neocon form and its more progressive form was always about let's roll back the state, like small government, Clinton. We want to reduce the power of government, Thatcher and Reagan, and so on and so forth. So there is a broad realization that we need the state back, and that the state, this is very important, should not just intervene in order to correct market failures, should not just be there to bail out the private sector when the private sector fails, but should take a more proactive and mission-oriented approach, as economist Mariana Mazzucato puts it. In a sense, it should identify area where it wants to deliver public goods that have no other justification than the good of society, that have no market justification, but have a social justification. Think about the environment, think about education, health, but also economic sectors that may not be best suited for the private sector.
And how is that... You talked about the politics of protection, which I think is a distinction. But how else does that differ from, say, the Keynesian model of, when the New Deal came out, which I know was designed to beat back fascism? Is this characterized by beating back something a bit different?
Yeah, it has to beat back right-wing populism.
Right.
That's fed on a sense of widespread anxiety, neglect, betrayal, and turning into resentment. Neoliberal policies have created a support base for very dangerous movements. So one of the greatest risks of neoliberalism is political. Neoliberalism has created the conditions for a possible authoritarian turn. But it is also a politics that has to do with facing conditions that are partly similar, as you were saying, to the New Deal or European social democracy, but that are very peculiar and specific to our historical time, right? Where we face a major historical challenge dealing with climate change, which doesn't necessarily have to be something catastrophic, as sometimes climate activists portray. But can also be a positive opportunity for society to reconsider its basic mechanisms, its way of functioning.
My producer Matt wrote in and wanted me to ask you this. I hope I characterize his question accurately, or maybe Matt, you could just say this into the mic.
Yeah, I'm curious. Like in a time where you expect the state to be more active, how do you feel about the prospects for democracy and like human input into those decisions? Do you see, and especially globally, like here things look pretty dire as far as attempts to roll back voting rights. I'm curious what your perspective is on that.
That is very important. Whenever the state power increases, democracy has to increase proportionately. Right? Otherwise, you can end up with an authoritarian statism, which is controlled not by democracy, but by technocracy. So in fact, control, which is another key term that I discuss in the book, is a key issue on the left in terms of recuperation of democratic control. I mean, if you look at social movements over the last 10 years, they have constantly voiced this demand of reconstructing channels to convey the popular will, to monitor representatives, to create a more stable league with representatives and to avoid the situation of Democrats in name only, right? Or like right, these politicians that have no connection, no responsibility anymore to their electorate. So that is definitely a very urgent issue to avoid that statism goes in an authoritarian direction.
Can you talk a bit about the concept of how globalization pushed outward and now something like the pandemic, the shock to the system, which I think just accelerated a lot of the devolution that we saw post 2008 and the economic collapse there, right? It was more of a, it forced people to speed up to the understanding that this is a failed system, that now we're seeing more, as you write about in your book, of an inward focus. And that is something that is mirrored globally and not just in the United States. We can see it around the world.
In a way, this is common to many phases of capitalism, right? These long waves, these K waves, as they were described, that last for 40, 50 years. You have this moment of expansion. It tends to be a moment of international integration. You had a similar phase, a similar globalization at the beginning of the 20th century before the two world wars. And though this globalization was the most intense, the most pervasive, the most far-reaching, it really kind of subsumed virtually the entire world economy under the same market and under the same financial market. And it was very much premised on this narrative of flat earth, open spaces, break all barriers, break all ties, red tapes, and so on and so forth. As you could see in this jargon, right, this jargon of externalization, outsourcing, outcontracting, offshoring, let's go out, right? This was the imperative, like, let's go out in the open. Yet, in a way, that also damaged the very support structures of society that allow the market to operate. Because the market doesn't operate in a void. The market operates thanks to the existence of social structures and of social infrastructures. And now we are realizing how much many of these structures have been eroded under neoliberalism and how they need to be reconstructed. How we need a process of recentering, of recovering, of repairing and rescuing, like to use some of the slogans used also by Biden's government, because without this institutional architecture of the state, ultimately, also the economy doesn't work. I mean, you could see that during the pandemic with hospitals. I mean, ultimately, a country that doesn't have an efficient public health sector suffers also economically. It is not anymore internationally competitive. And the same goes for a country that has rusty bridges, that has roads that are not working, or doesn't have high-speed train system as the U.S.
How does that play into narratives and the mood around the establishment and protection, to use your word, of sovereignty? Because we're talking about contracting inward, more of a focus, as opposed to these larger, more free-flowing openness narratives that seem both reflective in the pre-World War era and also reflective in the pre-pandemic, pre-economic collapse era. Or more pre-pandemic, frankly.
I mean, I think that what is at stake is not, I would just say, a complete bounce back to something that is entirely the opposite of globalization, right? In a sense that nobody wants to go to an autarkic condition, say, for example. Right? Not even North Korea, sometimes described as the hermit state, is really autarkic. Instead, in fact, it exists only thanks to trade with China and support from China. I think that the key issue here is, realizing that sovereignty means a very simple thing. I mean, in a way, it is a fancy word to say supremacy. And supremacy can mean many different things. Obviously, on the right, it is suprematism. It is these enter here your own people's name first, America first, Italy first, as Salvini in Italy used it. Like this idea that my country comes first, my country comes before anything else. But it can also mean more generally the supremacy of politics over economics. And on the left, it means popular sovereignty as the supremacy of the popular will of the majority, right? Of the will of everyone virtually, vis-a-vis the private interest, the particular interest of corporations, of lobbies, and people like Kyrsten Sinema and Giomanci. So in that sense, sovereignty is actually a very fundamental, it is a fundamental democratic principle, right? The fact that the will of the majority, the will of the people comes before private interest.
And how are some of these concepts distinct from populism or the populism that we saw in the 2010s, which would you characterize that as more of a initial heated reaction to the end of neoliberalism, and now we're in a different era than the one of, say, even the Sanders movement of 2016 and the Trump movement of 2016 as well?
Yes, exactly. In a way, the 2010s was the more virulent moment of the realization that something was profoundly wrong with the way the world was organized. And there were these bursts of mobilization on the left and the right, but it was not very clear what these movements wanted to propose, what was their positive content. In a way, it was more of a moment that revolved around a new form of politics, politics having to do with affective, charismatic mobilization, with leaders, be they Donald Trump on the right or Bernie Sanders on the left. While now a number of circumstances and the very clear perception of evil and of a negative reality and negative challenges in reality that confront us, we are compelled to reflect more about content as well, about the substance of politics, about the issues that confront us, and to develop more long-term strategies. So that is why we are moving from populism to neo-statism. So in that sense, you can look at the populist moment of the 2010s more as a moment of reorganization and gestation of new political actors, right, that are now taking a more clear shape, a more recognizable shape.
But do you think that the Sanders movement was more of a, despite having some of those same characteristics of virulence or anger, that was a movement centered around a substantive shift in politics, which I think is distinct?
Yes, definitely. I'm not saying that those movements did not have a platform, did not have an issue, but that some of the policies that have been developed in recent years. And in a way, we started, say, with Occupy Wall Street, and I've been kind of really following closely all these wave of movements. I remember those days, and people were in a very embryonic phase where they had a very clear sense of what was wrong, but they had not yet a clear sense of what the possible solutions were. So progressively, this critique, this denunciation of the problems was accompanied by solutions, by new policies. And only now, in a way, these policies are not only individual policies, but they are coming together in something akin to a platform, in something akin to kind of like really structured vision of the good society, like reclaiming an idea of the good society or what we want to build for the future. So in a way, it is the same actors that were populist in the 2010s are now becoming neo-statist as they're focusing more on contents. I mean, also kind of like Bernie Sanders is taking states' responsibilities now, like in Congress. Yolanda Diaz, leader of the Spanish left, is now focusing very much on policy. For example, she now approved this very important labor reform that makes permanent contract the default form of contract. So to me, it's just in a way a shift in emphasis, really, in a way in which politics operates.
I agree with you. I'm a little a bit discouraged by the left neo-statism not gaining a foothold to the same degree that, say, we're looking at the French election, for example. I mean, yes, there were gains made by Mélenchon in that election, but now there's a fight between the very seemingly archaic politics of Emmanuel Macron and a racist populist of the era. Even previously, there's a maybe you would characterize it differently if you think Le Pen has embraced more new statism. You would say that that's the case?
Definitely. I mean, her campaign poster was Femme d'État, which means stateswoman. That was the entire slogan, right? And that pretty much condenses her discursive strategy, not just now in these elections, but for many years now, that has to do with the normalization of her figure and a normalization of Rassemblement National, previously called Front National, shedding some of the encumbering kind of populist robes that they were carrying on from the 2010s, but also from before, and presenting herself in a way as a safe pair of hands, promising the public that she will not constitute a danger, say, for the stability and security of France.
Are there some policies in particular and priorities, given these dynamics, that either here in the United States or abroad, that the left should be emphasizing?
I think the problem with Bidenomics is that what it is a credit card state, right? It is a spending state. Rather generous, but rather generous ultimately with corporations, because all this spending, and all these trillions of dollars, though the total sum was much bigger at the start, are going to be funneled through corporations. Corporations are going to build the bridges, to repair the roads, to build railways, to do all these public works that the U.S. needs. And that is good, but there can be a far more active and a far more constructive way in which the state intervenes. So again, let's go back to the New Deal. I mean, Franklin Delano Roosevelt didn't just spend a lot of money. He also created many institutions, many agencies, many state agencies, like the Tennessee Valley Authority, many authorities around the U.S., where there were functionaries, there were bureaucrats. We should also reclaim bureaucrats because they have a function, allowed the state not only to spend money, but to actually shape society, to reorganize society. So that is the ambition that we should have. It shouldn't just be the ambition of building things. It should just be the ambition of whatever, providing stimulus or providing whatever, subsidies and transfer for how important they are. The ambition should be much bigger. It should be reorganizing society through the state, and recreating also community using the state as a lever. Because that is also what happened with the New Deal. The New Deal allowed trade unions to strengthen, community organizations to strengthen. So I'm not saying that the state is the solution. I'm seeing more the state and a recuperation of the state as an instrument to reconstruct social capacity in society as a whole.
And to pull some members of society away from a nationalist vision of the world, because without the more expansive vision that you describe, that is the more likely outcome, I would argue.
Yes, I mean, I think that these kind of projects, these kind of collective projects, these kind of national plans, and these forms of democratic planning, right, where the state is inviting citizens to discuss, to get on board, to get involved, are the best way to create a healthy pride in your community, in your locality, and in your nation, because there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is when national identity is connected with resentment. When national identity is purely a negative identity, it is not something you are proud of, but it's something that is linked to a sense of regret, to a melancholic yearning for something that doesn't exist. Right? So in a way, the best antidote to nationalism is a healthy, progressive patriotism, but grounded precisely in these concrete and material things that change people's lives for the better.
In what way can you mention bureaucrats? In what way can bureaucrats aid in that effort?
You know, bureaucracy has a very bad name and very bad press, but there is no modernity and there is no civilization, there is no technology without bureaucracy is what allows the state to know the world, like to know levels of pollution, for example, to know levels of poverty, to know how many patients you need to care for in a given area or region. And the state, by being rolled back, has actually lost so much of its ability to know the world, so that now often it needs to resort to these big four, like to these corporations that are providing consultancy to do very basic things that the state should do in-house.
Yes.
And while they're doing that, obviously they are also distorting the state's agenda and its priorities in a direction that is more conducive to their own agenda. So actually, a fundamental step here is creating new state functionaries, new state bureaucrats, especially recruited from the youth and also from working class backgrounds, because in so many areas there's need for new agencies that are fundamental to create this active and directive state.
An expansive bureaucracy, but one that is not, you know, expanding in within its current context. One that is expanding in the roles and systems that have to be new and created. I guess I was wondering if you could touch a little bit more on that concept of corporations serving state functions, because particularly in the pandemic here in the United States, we've seen the pitfalls of that. We're seeing it right now in the booster rollout. I mean, the fact we've contracted that out to drugstore companies to handle that. It's not gone that great here relative to Canada, other countries that are similar in status, wealth-wise, et cetera. But like even our lack of infrastructure, the only thing that's comparable or that's as expansive or even more expansive than state infrastructure is, say, Amazon's infrastructure. And so we have to fall back on outsourcing our projects to those corporations like that. I mean, how does that tension get broken?
Yeah, that is really wrong. Right? I mean, outsourcing functions that should be government's functions to private actors, like this empowers the state and deprives the state of capacity, but also of the ability to decide autonomously from economic actors. On so many levels, there are opportunities to create new public agencies and new state-owned, publicly owned companies. Think about the local level. I mean, there's many cities in Europe, for example, Barcelona, where new public energy companies have been created to deal with climate change. Because it is far, far easier, instead of telling companies what they need to do, instead of giving them targets on what they need to do, instead of telling them you need to produce renewables, it is far easier for a public authority, for example, a city council, to create a municipal company to produce energy so that the company already embodies, already follows the guidelines that have been collectively decided. food production and delivery. I mean, why do we need always to rely on all these companies that pay very bad salaries to workers and are not following any kind of public criterion? I mean, there's many sectors in which the state can also take a proactive role as a producer and distributor of goods that can also be public goods.
And lastly, this is more towards the conclusion of your book, where you talk a little bit about how the pandemic laid bare the pitfalls or the inability for the populist right wing to meet certain moments, as, for example, the inability to accept science, the rejection of it, and the clear fault lines between the vision that the left can create with a strong state versus what the right has been leaning on. Do you mind talking a bit about those differences and how the shock of the pandemic made those differences a bit clearer?
The strategy of the right hinges on this attempt to present itself as a champion of ordinary people. It cannot do that in on the economic front, because otherwise it would need to tax the rich. And it doesn't want to do that. It wants to protect the rich. Therefore, the only way in which it can do that is by waging the famous culture war, right? Which revolves around presenting this battle between ordinary people, especially located in peripheral areas, exurban and rural areas, and the elite, like middle-class people, people with college degrees, and so on and so forth, located in metropolitan areas. So these, the way in which the populist right has channeled these conspiracy theories during the pandemic was very much part of this broader strategy. Because doctors, scientists were presented as the new face of the progressive elites. Like, they were figures who were telling ordinary people what they needed to do. You need to wear a mask, you need to get a jab, you need to do this and that. And the right presented all these measures not as something based on necessity. You need to do it because actually there is a need for that, but based, whatever, on arbitrary decisions made by someone somewhere for mysterious reasons and potentially to profit on people in some mysterious way. And that kind of narrative was very effective for a small core of people, a small militant core. I mean, small, but scarily big enough. Right? I mean, there's some people, unfortunately, in society, we have come to realize that are really prone to buy into narratives that are lunatic. I mean, I don't think there's any other way to describe that. Yet at the same time, by the risk for the right is that if it follows the track, it ends up distancing itself from the majority of the electorate that often is not ready to buy into these narratives, including a sizable proportion of the Republican electorate, right? And therefore, sometimes it is forced to play a balancing act that can be quite dangerous given the moralistic character of culture wars. I mean, witness Donald Trump when, I think it was last August, he told a Republican audience that they had to get a jab, which was in his own self-interest, because if those people get COVID and die, I mean, those people are not going to vote for the Republican Party anymore. Right. It was booed, right, by the public, and similar things have happened with other leaders. Also not Putin, and sympathy for Putin, alliance with Putin, and even being bankrolled by Putin, as it is the case with some populist right leaders, is in a way coming back to haunt some populist leaders, right? It's quite paradoxical because these are people who represent themselves as the defenders of national interests and now can be easily cast as basically fifth columns of a very dangerous figure that has invaded Ukraine, creating a bloodshed.
And actually, lastly, what is your opinion on how they are able to walk that tightrope currently? I hope it backfires and I hope it's as dangerous as you say. But my perception of it is that they conflate cultural elites, doctors, as you say, experts, people who they present as talking down to you, as they conflate those experts with cultural elites, as opposed to the moneyed elites that the left and the capitalists that the left should be coalescing behind combating. And they're able to muddy the waters to a degree that benefits them at the very least in the short term electorally.
Yes, I mean, unfortunately, never underestimate the ability of the right to walk a tightrope and to juggle apparently irreconcilable ideas and demands. That is partly to do with the fact that why the center-left and the left in particular has this very high self-image and is very wary of going into contradictions between its morality and its politics. That is usually not such a big problem for the right. The right is very able to change according to circumstances, to adapt. It is far more malleable, which is a huge advantage. And it's also the reason why they adapted to this new situation much earlier than the left. They were already into this new post-neoliberal framework in the mid-2010s, basically. Mm. While we are now basically just catching up there. Yet at the same time, you also need to say that there is a certain memory, despite our very short attention spans. So you saw now there was this very peculiar scene recently of Salvini, the leader of the populist right party in Italy, Lega, who was ridiculed in a Polish town where he had gone to offer his solidarity to Ukrainian refugees. And the Polish mayor of the town showed the T-shirt with which Salvini had taken a selfie, a T-shirt celebrating Putin. Mm. So he was completely ridiculed in front of the crowd, right? So, I mean, people remember things and people learn things. The problem, though, I think, is lack of decisiveness on the left, lack of decisiveness by our politicians. I mean, look at Biden. Like, he's always, you know, one step ahead and one step backwards, saying one thing and then retreating and then denying what he said. Why, comparing with Trump, Trump never said, I was wrong, basically, right? Mm. Never backtracked. Never. So I'm not saying that one has to do like Trump, but neither one has to constantly correct, constantly, you know, justify, moderate. I think a bit more self-assuredness, a bit more boldness, a bit more self-belief in ultimately in our values and our ability to change society is a fundamental ingredient if we are to avoid the populist right coming back, which is very, unfortunately, a very serious, a very real scenario in the case of the U.S. in particular.
Paolo Gerbado, sociologist and author of The Great Recoil, Politics After Populism and the Pandemic. Paolo, thank you so much for your time today. It was really excellent. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
With that, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program. But first, Matt, what happened last night on Left Reckoning?
Oh, yeah, Elias.
Whoa!
Yeah, look at that. I will be on a little bit on camera this week.
Oh, my goodness.
We had Elias Cepeda on. We talked about UFC and Dana White. And I'm really fascinated by Marxist critiques of sporting. And UFC is insane. First of all, the athletes do not have a union. UFC.
Are they still independent contractors, or was that the WWE? I couldn't remember.
They're still independent contractors.
Because John Oliver did a segment on it a while ago that I was damning.
And UFC stands for United Fighting Championships, right? Maybe I'm wrong about that. I assume that's what you mean, but anyway, yeah. They don't have unions.
Bradley says WWE also doesn't have a union, so there you go.
And they also, Elias went into this interesting thing of, basically some owners were on the Nevada Gaming Commission and rejected UFC's bid to become a, like, you know, get the official imprimatur of the Gaming Commission. And then after they denied that and UFC sort of value tanked, they went and bought UFC. And then now it's, I mean, some really crazy stuff. So we talked about that a little bit in Dana White's racism. And we also talked about Bernie 2024 and Julian Assange. And then we had a good fun post game. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. This weekend for patrons, I'll be talking to Brian Box Brown about pot legalization, where we stand. We talked with him earlier in Left Reckoning, and we're going to go back for an update. So look forward to that.
What's interesting too, that you could get into, I don't know if you did, but maybe in a part two, if you focused, you did the UFC and then also the WWE, all that Linda McMahon stuff and the McMahon connections to the Republican Party are interesting as well.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. They founded WWE and then she got some cushy job in the Trump administration, big Republican donors. Yeah. Those ties that are fascinating. Do we have a? Oh, there we do. Oh, wow. We do have Brandon and Matt, who will appear on screen very shortly. Or if they can't appear on screen, just put their audio up or whatever, and they can explain what's happening on their shows before we head to the fun half.
Sorry, I'm having an issue with the Thursday frames. We might have to take a break them up. Yeah.
All right. Well, check out Doomed. Check out the Scam Economy. Check out the Discourse. Pretty please. Do it. And then in the fun half, we'll have our friends Binder and Brandon explain what's happening on their shows. 646-257-3920. We will see you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Key.
You did it.
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm gonna go tell that.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though. Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3-8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.